Geekscape.com.
National Socialism. World Creed for the Future. Part 3 by Colin Jordan. Along with recognizing and pursuing its implications, even to the extent of religion, we have to present and emphasize all the cultural implications of this life-wide creed of ours. The total war is to be fought on all fronts and to the neglect of none. All art forms can either be in accord with National Socialism, as expressive of harmony and order, or in conflict with it, in departure from these qualities. Just as the sublime grandeur of the music of Wagner is pure National Socialism in sound, so is the primitively repetitive and diabolically discordant din of rap, particularly in its extreme forms, anti-NS chaos in this medium, and its hideous purveyors are to be attacked as fiercely as any renegade politician or race-mixing cleric in theirs. Likewise, the mass daubing of modern painting is chaos in line and colour, and thus an expression of anti-National Socialism. Likewise, the indeterminate shapes of modern sculpture are also anti-National Socialism in whatever the material used. Their deranged perpetrators are part of this multifarious array of the active enemy. Those persons who call themselves National Socialists, but at least tolerate these forms of decadency in their perniciously partial and superficial understanding and acceptance of our creed, if they do not actually dabble in them themselves, are not really on our side, and we would be better off without them, as they are. In advocating leadership with its personal responsibility instead of the collective irresponsibility and inertia which characterizes and condemns democracy, providing the opportunity for great vested interests and alien elements to rule by manipulation from behind the scenes, it is not enough to cite the superlative qualities and achievements of Adolf Hitler. Of him there has been one, and one no more. It is incumbent on us to devise a system of honest and effective representation of the people, consistent with true leadership, whereby it is clear that we uphold this form of freedom for the people, and that we reject democracy precisely because it fails to provide this whilst pretending to do so. In the course of this, proper provision must be made for the succession in the event of death, incapacity, or downright failure of the leader, in the understanding that this planet can hardly hope to be lucky enough to be presented with a second Hitler in the immediate future. Another problem that National Socialism in this preparatory period of searching review has to resolve is the adjudication of the National Socialist state as a zealous promoter of the National Socialist good between the advantages and disadvantages of so-called free speech. To allow the propagation of what is distinctly and seriously harmful, according to the National Socialist view, is clearly abhorrent and impossible, but seriously harmful too can be any suppression of justifiable criticism and the protection this undoubtedly gives to abuses and defects. We have to determine and justify the precise position we propose to adopt in this respect, bearing in mind that bans and punishments should be the last resort, and the fewer, the better, being an admission of the failure of National Socialism in obtaining the end by other and earlier means, and that any appearance of being unable to face the arguments of opponents in open controversy is undesirable. Another important field for the formulation of extended national socialism to fit our own times and places is that of industrial relations. Here, we have to be able to detail a permanent remedy for the continual conflict and perpetual strikes ravaging the economy in Britain and other countries, and of a nature which disposes of the Marxist argument that National Socialism is the servant or ally of capitalism. All workers and employers need to be bound by some contract of employment under some charter of industry, which accords to each both the rights and the obligations of their positions, including that of arbitration, which excludes strikes and lockouts as outdated demonstrations of economic anarchy, which provides for workers' representation throughout the community and for workers' shares in the profits of the firm. Along with this introduction of just and mutually beneficial economic government in the place of internecine chaos, there needs to be the abolition of those schemes of the misnamed welfare state, which, whatever they may provide from the public purse by way of general taxation, take away personal responsibility, breed dependence, and encourage the lazy and improvident to exploit the industrious and the thrifty. Instead, the system of the National Socialist State should ensure, after exaction of proportionately less taxation, an adequate net wage to everyone who does an adequate day's work, and then require its citizens to assume responsibility for themselves and pay their way, and in respect of any special assistance needed in an emergency, ultimately to repay its provision. The double-headed dictum of National Socialist economic justice should thus be: no one shall want through no fault of his own, and no one shall gain through no effort of his own. This does not, of course, preclude any and all social provisions based on a direct and adequate personal contribution. In all its economic and social plans, the true development of National Socialism is, and has been shown and stressed as, something neither of capitalism nor Marxism, being not for one class or the other, or any section whatsoever, but for the whole community, and based not on a cash nexus, but on the bond of race. Because of this, we are National Socialists, in fulfilling and asserting this revolutionary distinction, have relentlessly to reject being labelled as some kind of right-wing nationalists. Being no part of the old order, we are against the right, the left, and the centre. We have not only to avoid deviation into confusion with right-wing nationalism in its economic and social aspects, we have also to break free from, reject, and rise above that right-wing nationalism in its external aspect, which up to now has been so much confused with and so greatly compromised and corrupted National Socialism, deforming it to tremendous loss. We have to go forward into the future with a dynamic answer both to the nationalism and the internationalism of both capitalism and Marxism. That answer must be the worldwide call of Aryan kinship to create, above all, lesser attachments and divisions of class and country, a real community of united Aryan peoples. Nothing less than this is the maturity of our creed in the fulfilment of its implications of the Aryan folk. It may be that National Socialism had, in the 1930s, to find its beginning and make its early way through a resurgence of nationalism as the root of the times, and indeed to take this into its very title for its folkism as a matter of contemporary convenience rather than eternal aptness of definition. Yet from our vantage point today, it cannot be denied that, if nationalism was utilised to carry it forward, the same nationalism reacted to hold it back. We serve our creed best today not by pretending that everything was perfect in the past, which is a way to confine it to the past and deprive it of a future, but by recognizing any errors or imperfections from a National Socialist point of view. Providing this is done with ample reason and in perspective, within a context of overall appreciation of the nevertheless gigantic achievements of the past, and constructively, in order thereupon to correct and improve. National Socialism is not for export, as a pronouncement attributed to the Third Reich may well have served certain purposes, including the major truth that each particular country needed to evolve its own particular form. But taken as it may so very easily be done, as the confinement of the whole doctrine to one people, one country, and one time, this total endorsement of exclusive local nationalism is an appalling deformation of true National Socialism. This restrictive element of the old nationalism, which probably prevailed most of the time among the adherents of the German National Socialism of the 1930s, did immense harm to its prospects in reducing the power of its appeal to those outside Germany to join in, preventing the move to war, and after the war had broken out, to side with Germany in a European new order. At the same time, it was reflected in the forms of professed National Socialism, which arose in other countries. In Britain, the same old nationalism led Mosley, after so commendably opposing the move to war, to exhort his followers, after it had broken out and the testing time had come, not to hinder the conduct of the war against Germany. It led to most of his followers, in fact, actively aiding the war against National Socialism, many of them in the forces, and to followers of his even now proudly upholding this in their favour. That insane, fratricidal, inter-Aryan war, which brought about the physical downfall of what, despite any and all shortcomings, was most certainly the finest achievement so far of the self-conscious Aryan spirit and will, was the result of German and other European and Aryan nationalism exploited by Jewish international racialism. This is the monumental lesson to be learned now, at long last, and never henceforth to be forgotten. Never must it happen again. The remedy can be nothing other than the emergence of Aryan international racialism, leading to the unity of the whole Aryan folk. Though the old restricted nationalism still pervaded not only the great bulk of the German population under National Socialism, but also the great bulk of party members and the great bulk of German National Socialist exposition, the new extended racialism of the future, which is the fullest flowering of our creed and our task now to propagate, showed itself appropriately in that part of the German movement which was its highest elite. The foremost leaders and thinkers of the SS were distinctly pan-Aryan in their outlook, and this outlook was reflected in the formations of European volunteers which the SS sponsored and possessed by the best of those volunteers themselves. Theirs, then, was the vision which in time and force could have won the war. Now, theirs is the vision with which, in the future, the defeat of 1945 can be made but a lost battle in a continuing war which ends in our total and everlasting victory. This will be so if the National Socialist elite, which is what the National Socialist movement of the present and the future must be, will embrace it wholeheartedly and carry it forward fanatically. A racialism which is purblindly partial is not good enough. The racial nationalist who keenly invokes racial factors relating to the nation and then stops short and equally keenly turns his back in purblind partiality on the way in which the same racial factors proclaim an entity above and beyond the nation is a self-destructive and split personality. The existing nation-states, to whatever extent they are now or have been homogenetic racial units, arose in the course of migrations and divisions of the great race and are only one form of a folk community, and no divinely ordained highest and final form, as the myopic nationalists in Britain and elsewhere try to make out.